There are few places on earth like a college campus. Different generations, all walks of life, from around the country.
I grew up in LA, but I've always wanted to be a Sooner.
And the world.
I lived in Panama, and now I'm at OU studying creative media production.
Living on campus together, broadening our horizons.
There are ways to think about this that I never thought about before.
Learning, growing, making mistakes.
When it started hailing during our study, I knew that we had miscalculated.
And achieving remarkable things.
I got to help with cancer research, and I'm only an undergrad.
I'm Emily Tackett, and this is Just So, an OU podcast about thought leaders here in the heartland. There's a world of voices on this campus, but there's only one Oklahoma. Today on Just So, we have a historian.
I am Dr. Jane Wickersham. I'm an associate professor and the director of undergraduate studies in the history department. I'm an early modern Europeanist historian.
And a literary scholar.
My name is Katie Krieger, and I am a first-year PhD student in the English department. So I'll be doing literature and culture, focusing on medieval and early modern literature.
Brought together by intersecting courses of study.
So I tend to teach all of early modern Europe, and that's where Katie and I converge a bit here on the literature and history front.
And Game of Thrones fandom.
I do have a dog, and his name is Tyrion Lannister, so obviously I have an affinity for Tyrion Lannister.
Coming together to talk about subversive themes, historical and literary references, surprise dragons, and the overall masterful storytelling in Game of Thrones, the show that has captivated fans and shattered HBO viewership records. The season 7 debut had 10.1 million viewers, and another 6 million from DVR playback and streaming services, making it the most watched premiere in HBO history. Why is the show relevant in academia? What does it reveal about modern fans? And how is the series critiquing the mythic ideal? Who better to answer these questions than a historian and a literary scholar? Let's get to the interview. Most people's stereotypes of the Middle Ages and early modern period in Europe involves lords and ladies, kings and queens, tournaments and chivalry, which is where, in part, we start in season one, book one. So how does George R.R. Martin undercut or problematize these stereotypes?
I think where a lot of students wind up getting surprised is just how different the reality could be historically from the stereotype. And the stereotype is oftentimes created in literature. So maybe you should tackle explaining the origin of some of those stereotypes first.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Then we can talk about the ways in which maybe they are not reflecting the historical reality.
Yeah, so absolutely. When we see sort of medieval literature, it's a very oral tradition that then gets written down. So you're always going to have an interpretation problem when you're taking sort of oral histories and stories and translating those into literature. And of course, being storytellers, we always want to embellish and make it a little bit more dramatic. And so that's what ends up happening in sort of medieval to early modern literature. And you have sort of dramatic retellings. I mean, Shakespeare is a wonderful example of how you can take sort of mundane things and add comedy and drama and then sort of move history in a different direction and have the audience interpret it in a different way. And so in terms of sort of the lords and ladies construct, I mean, we do have sort of feudal societies and these certain hierarchical structures. But I think where Game of Thrones likes to sort of tease things is introducing these concepts that we are familiar with and then subverting those. So, oh, here's your traditional lady, but then kind of over the series, developing those into very different ideas of what that might be.
They think, okay, you have princes and princesses and lords and ladies, and they were rich and privileged and did whatever they wanted. And then you had peasants who dug around in the dirt, and there was very, very little in between. And I think one of the things that I like about season one is that they do sort of have, for me it was the joust to celebrate Ned Stark becoming the Hand of the King. Well, the first problem is the treasury's broke and no one can pay for it. Students are always surprised to find out how debt-ridden most medieval and early modern monarchies were. Like, Philip of Spain declared bankruptcy 4 times in the 16th century. They were always short of money. They were always short. So Ned Stark's, you know, sort of grumping around like, how are we going to pay for this? We need to cancel it. King doesn't care. And then, you know, they put the tournament on, but the audience is, you know, sort of, they see what's behind it that oftentimes was there in the history books as well, but it's not the stereotype.
With bankrupt kings, Game of Thrones subverts themes and adds complex dimensions to familiar stereotypes of the Middle Ages. By adding these fresh perspectives, are we getting more realistic aspects of the time period than we're used to? Take the realities of being a princess, for example.
Say you're a princess. Yes, you grow up in a castle. Yes, you are very well fed. In some ways, you are a bit more protected from catching nasty diseases like the bubonic plague. Although Shireen gets grayscale.
Correct.
Yes. Which is loosely analogous mm-hmm. to leprosy, which was like the most feared medieval disease. Mm-hmm. But at a certain point, you will get put in a carriage or on a ship or on a horse, and you are going to be shipped off somewhere, and you are going to face this guy that you have never met, and you are going to marry him, and then you are going to have sex with him, and odds are witnesses will actually probably have to verify it because the marriage isn't legal if it isn't consummated. Think about that as your life role and what that means in a concrete term. Yes, you get to sit at the joust and have someone declare you the most beautiful. But what it, you know, the life that you have to lead is actually not do whatever you want. You're going to have to marry a stranger. And, you know, for me, one of the, you know, sort of the contrasting relationships is Catelyn and Ned versus Cersei and Robert Baratheon. You know, Catelyn and Ned were, it was an arranged marriage. They had not met. She was engaged to his older brother first. And then the older brother died. Believe it or not, that was actually Catherine of Aragon and Henry VIII. Mm-hmm. Henry VIII had an older brother. His name was Arthur. If you name your son Arthur and you are a member of the British royal family, you are basically making sure he will die before taking the throne. That's just like the general rule.
I didn't know that.
But he had married Catherine of Aragon. And then he died like 18 days later or something. And so they waited for Henry to grow up because he was only like 12. And when he hit 18, they married. And actually, ideal arranged marriage was that you learn to develop affection for each other. So in that sense, Catelyn and Ned are actually like the ideal of a medieval noble marriage. Cersei and Robert, on the other hand.
That's where the show diverges from the historical precedent a little bit. But you can see the princess stereotype play out in complicated ways with other characters in the show. Some stories get romanticized.
When we glimpse Cersei's daughter, Marcella, and that she was put in a ship and sent far away to Dorne. And then she does develop these very intense affection and love for her betrothed Trystane. But I think, you know, it gets glamorized in the show, obviously, and even in certain courtly romances that you can read from like the Arthurian legends and things, there is sort of this glamour and this awe of love. However, the reality is it's a little bit like Stockholm syndrome, and you sort of learn to love who you're around and your captors, and you see good qualities as humans often try to find. So there's definitely a lot to unpack in those stereotypes.
While others reflect the worst case scenario.
Quite frankly, if it didn't work out as a noblewoman or even a princess, you had no recourse. You had no options. And so as awfully exaggerated as Sansa's experience has been, in some ways, I think that's George R.R. Martin kind of taking it to the, like, ridiculous. And in some ways, Benioff and Weiss as well, because there's some things that happen to Sansa that don't happen to Sansa in the books.
In the book.
it happens to someone else in the books. The gorgeous Joffrey and the reasonably attractive Ramsay were monsters. And what position is she in? What support does she have? What can she literally do about this? So in some ways, you know, Martin does undercut, like, when you think of being a princess, the princess fantasy. Reality is that being a princess was not, I mean, it was a life of privilege, but it was not an easy job. I mean, if this was your lot in life, it had its pitfalls.
the role of a princess was stereotypically narrow, leaving a lot of space for Game of Thrones to reimagine and show more sometimes grim facets of royal life.
In some ways, I think the women characters on the show are the ones that are really used to kind of critique this mythic idea of the past. Although in a certain sense, some of the male characters too, like Jaime Lannister, you know, the knight who was supposed to defend the king, turned around and stabbed him. Now, yes, his father was attacking the city at the time, and everybody assumed that was the motivation, that he was willing to betray his vows as a knight and as a member of the king's guard, you know, basically to do his dad a favor. And then we find out later on that that actually wasn't his motivation at all. It was that the king had gone completely insane and was going to firebomb the entire city and kill thousands of innocent people. So in that sense, you know, some male characters are used to, like, undercut the idea, like, okay, so what is an honorable person? What is the honorable thing to do? Does this knightly code even make sense on a practical level? Everybody in the show who always does the right thing winds up dead. Like, that's really...
Well, and I think it's an interesting... in writing about Brienne, I sort of came to know the character and how she upholds oaths, even when the person, like Catelyn Stark, who she gave the oath to, is dead. I mean, there's plenty of characters, like the Hound, who's like, how are they going to know if you, you know, upheld the oath? And it is. It's about the word and the code of a knight. Now, what's interesting with Brienne in the most recent season is she kind of breaks out of that tradition and realizes that, you know, she's upheld her oath to Catelyn Stark. She now works closely with Sansa and Arya, and she's taken on that sort of yoke of protection for them. But she steps outside of her character and approaches Jaime because she knows his background and his story, as you were saying. Mm-hmm. And she's like, this is about more than just, you know, this war in front of us. This is a lot bigger, and this is more than the oaths we've taken as knights. And so I think she's reminding him of, you know, hey, that time that you killed the king for a specific reason and you realized it was much bigger. She's reminding him of the same thing, especially since he has so much sway and hold, she thinks, over Cersei.
And it was very startling to see Brienne of Tarth of all people come out. Yep. And, okay, one drop an F-bomb that we will not say on air here in Oklahoma. But she is, you know, is expletive loyalty. You know, for the Oath Keeper, mm-hmm. who always, even though Catelyn Stark died, did
season
what
after season.
Season after season, finally stands there and is like, now is not the time to be doing this. So it's really an interesting exploration. And, you know, Arya is going to have her own, well, quasi-ethical decisions to make, although she's kind of already made quite a few of them. She does get trained to fight, but she's also basically turned into an assassin at this point, so... Now, whether she's assassinating people on behalf of her sister or, you know, getting back at, you know, everybody who's messed with the Starks, mm-hmm. you know, will she ever... And, you know, that's something that I actually think will be interesting about the final season. You know, right now we're all egging Arya on because we really sympathize with, you know, why she wants to kill the people she kills. Will she ever decide to kill someone? And we're like, no! And so they kind of tease that with Sansa a little bit, but will they ever kind of... really good, like, go for that, really, because it'll really be interesting to see if they ever, like, will really challenge the audience's feelings for Arya by, like, oh my god, she's actually not a good person anymore, you know.
too dark.
That leads me to ask what sources these stereotypes came from in reality.
A paper that I have been working on sort of draws a relationship between one of Spencer's knights, who happens to be a female, named Britomart. And I sort of talk about how George R. R. Martin brings in Britomart to write the character of Brienne of Tarth, and then takes a lot of those concepts about Britomart, because she's very much this knight, but when they describe her, she's that ideal princess. And so she's got this beautiful hair. Every time she takes her helmet off, she, like, stops the buses and everyone's in love with her. And that's not what we see with Brienne of Tarth. I mean, oftentimes her physical appearance is talked about in a very negative aspect. She's only attractive to the wildlings, to Tormund in particular. And that's
all rooting for that.
Yeah, we're all rooting for Tormund and Brienne. And that's been very fan-driven, too. So there's a lot of attention to the audience and sort of where the audience wants to see things go. But there's a lot of relationships between sort of these literary influences and what Martin brings into the books and then what gets visually communicated. I think it's been really interesting to have a literary knowledge and approach certain scenes. I definitely feel like I can predict things, and then, of course, they just cut me off. And I'm like, oh, but I know the story. I totally know this story. And I'm completely wrong most of the time because they've taken that story and twisted it.
Everybody probably who watches Game of Thrones knows that Martin was kind of inspired by the Wars of the Roses, which was the Lancastrians and the Yorks going toe-to-toe for the Kingdom of England.
And many other far-reaching historical references.
The Free Cities. Now, as an Italian Renaissance-era historian into the Reformation, I look at Braavos and I'm like, oh, that's Venice. Like, the way the city is laid out, tons of canals. Except for the Iron Bank, which is probably based on the Medici. The Dothraki. Clearly, the Mongols are kind of inspiring the Dothraki screamers. I mean, and the design aesthetic, you know, like when you're doing the big tour of the, you know, places in this universe, and they go to Meereen and there's the Ziggurat Pyramid. Okay, that's like Ur, the ancient city-state, but that's like 3000 BC.
And what about the mythical monsters in Game of Thrones? Where do those come from?
There's a lot of Norse legend, I think. Like, White Walkers makes me think of frost giants, which is from Norse legends. I think the other pop culture context that it's come up in recently is the Thor movies.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like the ice beings that can kill you with a touch. Uh-huh. Right. Okay. That's actually from Norse legend.
In history, Norse or Norsemen were old Norse-speaking tribes living in southern and central Scandinavia. And then, of course, there are the dragons.
Oh, God, the dragons. Multiple cultural sources.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. A lot of texts like Marvels of the East often reference dragons. In most, like, Spenserian sort of knight tales, you're going to come up against a dragon, whether it's like the end all be all fight, usually isn't. Usually they're like, they just pop up along the way, like, oh, surprise dragon. You know, when these kind of ideas and creatures came about, they were actually a lot more mundane than what we're seeing now.
Yeah, Beowulf,
scary.
Yeah, Beowulf does call it the Great Worm.
Yeah, the Great Worm. Dragon's not so scary in Beowulf's time.
Yeah, seriously. They did have an imagination for, like, otherworldly creatures that are, you know, sort of definitely different. But just in terms of scale, I mean, the dragons on the show are, like, portrayed as 737 size, basically. I don't think the Middle Ages really had a sort of mental concept of the scale of that.
Right. We've scaled up the dragon.
We've scaled up the dragon. In terms of, like, how big we think a dragon needs to be impressive.
Do you guys think that the violence and torture on the show is realistic, or is it a little
excessive? Oh, okay, yeah. So that whole Inquisition scholar thing means I get this question a lot. and the answer is no, it is not at all realistic. And again, I think this is a function of what it takes to have a modern audience think something is really, really bad. And quite frankly, I mean, I don't know if you've ever heard of, like, you know, torture museums in Europe. The vast majority of the torture instruments that are in torture museums in Europe were not ever actually used. In fact, I'm not even quite sure where they come from. There is a part of the legal history of Europe that did use torture judicially. Like, if you needed somebody to confess, you tortured them to get them to confess. The way they did it was bad, but it was not Ramsay Bolton bad. Trust me on that one. I mean, that's really, like, part of the show that's really, I think, over the top, but deliberately so. I think Martin's making a point with that.
What do you think that point is?
Honestly, I think in some ways he's using those exaggerations to say, okay, Middle Ages was lords and ladies and knights and kings and queens, but Middle Ages is also the phase of European history where torture entered the legal system as a valid part of a judicial system. There is this flip side that most people really don't. And I think it's also entertainment. I think, you know, what a modern audience is going to find, you know, in the wake of, like, you know, The Walking Dead or George Romero zombie movies or, you know, all the things that we have gotten used to seeing on a screen since the 1950s and, you know, movies and TV. I think if it's going to function as letting the audience know that this guy really is deplorable, what they actually did back in the day wouldn't cut it.
This is what it sort of takes for us to think things are bad. What does that say about a modern audience? I mean, for the torture to need to be that bad, to freak us out and to think people are terrible, anything lesser than that, I mean, if you think about it, it's still pretty terrible, but what does that say about us as a
where
society?
We are.
What does that say about us where we are?
And yeah. Technology and everything that we have the capacity to do. There's this, I think if people really invest themselves in the show, they sort of walk out questioning, you know, whether it's the torture or the incest. They're like, oh, why am I okay with this? But I am. Why? So there's a lot of questioning from Martin and Benioff and Weiss to the audience, which actually does stem out of sort of an early modern tradition. Shakespeare was very good at this, Ben Jonson, sort of bringing in these really big concepts like religion and the system, the governing systems, torture, all of these things, and setting them up in the audience's mind of, okay, so you're okay with this in an entertainment purpose, but this stuff happens in real life and we're not okay with it. Or, you know, what level of okay, we're good to go are you on this scale? You know, are you fine with John and Daenerys flirting but not when they actually have sex? Like, what is your breaking point?
Or are you fine with John and Daenerys but you're not okay with Jamie and Cersei?
They sort of walk out questioning, you know, whether it's the torture or the incest. They're like, oh, why am I okay with this? But I am. Why?
Historically, life, you know, was not the ideal. I think he does in some ways portray not only what this says about us as a modern audience, but also don't glorify the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I mm-hmm. think that's also something that, and you know, and we're back to our students coming in with this very sort of static idea of what the Middle Ages was like. You had these people and they did this, and you had these people and they did this, and everybody always behaved in their appropriate categories of ways. And he's like, that's not life. That's not how people live. That's not how we live now. Why do you think that's how they lived then?
Game of Thrones is dramatic, violent, and surprising, but it also breaks away from the static portrayals of the past, showing the complexity of the human narrative. And if that doesn't help you feel more connected to humanity, at least you can talk about the Middle Ages more bravely at tailgates.
So they can't always walk into a party that's going on or a tailgate and say, oh, hey, you know, let's talk about courtly romance. And I mean, you're just going to be like the buzzkill of everything. But if you can use your knowledge and that information and then use these modern references, I think it allows everyone to participate in the conversation, which is really cool.
That's it for this week. Thanks to Drew Bernard and Angela Starts for their help producing this podcast. Don't forget to subscribe so you can stay updated on what thought leaders in the Heartland are researching, thinking, and in this case, watching on TV. Keep a lookout for our next episode where we'll get both apocalyptic and hopeful insights about plagues and people with Dr. Tassie Hirschfeld. See you then.